Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This week, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo highlighted a major challenge facing the nation's largest city.
Downstate New York, you have a traffic problem that is only getting worse.
So lawmakers upstate in Albany did something about it. They passed a congestion pricing plan for New York City. That means in late 2020, drivers will be charged an extra toll to roll into the heart of Manhattan. The hope? Reduce traffic and pollution, and raise revenues for New York's suffering subway system. It has been tried in other international cities, London, Stockholm, and Singapore, for example, with varying results. Among New Yorkers, reaction was mixed, as these Manhattan residents told CBS New York on Monday.
This is really socking us in all the wrong places for all the wrong reasons.
I'm in favor of congestion pricing because, at least in theory, it will help contribute to the cost of maintaining public transportation.
But the plan's fiercest critics say it's a regressive tax, one that penalizes the middle class and separates the haves even further from the have-nots. So this hour on Point, congestion pricing and the pros and cons of new models for paying for transportation. And you can join us. What do you make of this idea of instituting a congestion pricing plan in New York City? If you're in another traffic-heavy American city, say Los Angeles, Houston, Atlanta, would you be in favor of this idea of charging drivers an extra toll to enter the most congested parts of your city? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we'll start today, of course, in New York City with David Meyer. He's a senior reporter for the news advocacy organization Streets Blog NYC, which is in favor of congestion pricing. We have a link to his piece headlined "A Slippery Slope: Do Albany's Congestion Toll Exemptions Set a Dangerous Precedent?" That link is at onpointradio.org. David Meyer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
I understand first that you just barely got to the studio in time because you were taking the train to get there.
Yes. Well, you know, you can time for a 38-minute trip, but you can't predict a sick passenger at the stop ahead of you that holds you for 15.
Oh, okay.
So I ran from the train, and I am here and happy to be here.
Okay. So not necessarily the MTA's fault today, but...
Yeah. Well, the MTA has to get better at turning around those incidents so that they impact riders less, but they are, from what we understand.
Okay,
so
we were thinking that it was just another infrastructure-related delay, but we were talking to you about the subway system in New York for a second, but let's focus on this congestion pricing plan, which is supposed to be launched in New York in late 2020 after the 2020 election. First of all, tell us more about what we know about the contours of the plan. How much is Albany considering charging drivers coming into the city?
So Governor Cuomo formed a panel. He likes to form a lot of panels. He formed a panel last July, I want to say, August 2017. And eventually they came out with a set of recommendations. They recommended an $11 toll for passenger vehicles and a $25 toll for trucks. However, the bill that the Assembly and Senate passed this weekend does not include any specific toll amounts. It very broadly specifies who will be required to pay the tolls, and it basically passes that buck to another panel, which will be created by the MTA with members primarily appointed by the governor, one person recommended by the mayor. That panel will come up with the toll amounts, will come up with any exemptions to the tolls, pass them on to the MTA board, which will approve them by the end of 2020.
Okay, so there's certainly going to be a lot of skirmishing over the exemptions, right? Because because the idea isn't to charge everybody who this you know $10 to $25 toll. Who's lining up to be exempt from it right now?
Well, so in the bill itself, they only outlined three exemptions. One was for quote emergency authorized vehicles, so ambulances. Term defined in the state vehicle and traffic law. One was for vehicles carrying handicapped persons, which will be defined by the panel that meets and then makes its recommendations to the MTA. And the third was for Manhattanites, people living below 60th Street, which is the toll zone that was created by the bill, who make less than $60,000 a year. And that final exemption wouldn't actually be an exemption. They would pay the toll, and then it would count as a tax refund at the end of the year.
Okay.
So moving forward, this panel will now be empowered to enact any exemptions for people that have maybe crossed another bridge into the city or tunnel into the city, for people with certain income levels, for people with disabilities, et cetera, et cetera. The hope, however, is that this panel, because it will be made up of transportation and municipal finance professionals, will keep those exemptions as limited as possible. Because the more exemptions we have, the less effective the program is.
Right. That's
and
the,
I spoke that, with Sam.
I was just going to say that that's a fundamental tension here with the whole concept, wherever congestion pricing has been launched around the world. Where do you set the price and who do you exempt? Because if you're trying to raise revenues on the one hand, you want to charge as many people as possible. But there's a fairness issue as well about there's certain people who shouldn't have to bear the burden of these tolls.
Right. And here's the thing. We have bridge tolls on every single bridge and tunnel that enters New York City, except for four. And the original idea behind congestion pricing was that we were going to add tolls to those bridges. 10 years later, we're not actually tolling the bridges. We're tolling the streets right after you get off the bridges. But the same idea stands. Tolls are things that people pay to get over bridges. They're not necessarily progressive taxes. They are in a way regressive, but they're still a form of policy that we've had in place for years. In one way, this plan, this congestion pricing plan, only rationalizes those tolls so that they're spread equally among all the crossings. Mm. That said, there is talk of exemptions, and elected officials are very wary of passing any new tolls. That's why they passed the responsibility of actually enacting the tolls to this panel, because they don't actually want to be the ones responsible for doing that. And they're going to try to exempt as many people as possible. Here's the thing. From our perspective and from the advocates' perspective, there is nothing more regressive than forcing the people riding in the most affordable and therefore most accessible and democratic transit option buses to sit in 4.7 mile per hour traffic with people traveling in single occupancy vehicles.
Right.
So when we're talking about equity in this context, we need to think about it on both ends. We need to think about it. Yes, we don't want somebody who has no choice but to drive into Manhattan to get charged $50 for doing that when they can barely afford dinner. That's fine. However, the vast majority of people who are in that financial situation are transit riders. The amount of people who are driving every day into Manhattan to commute, who are making below the federal poverty line, is negligible. And ultimately, when policymakers are thinking about congestion pricing, they have to think about how can we benefit the most possible people. And that requires the pricing scheme actually reducing the amount of traffic in the central business district.
Well, so this is the heart of the question of congestion pricing, especially in America, about whether or not it's time for us to change how we think about how we should pay for transportation and transportation infrastructure. And should it be based on demand, or is it a right that everyone should have access to? Specifically, I'm talking about roads and driving. But David Meyer, hang on here for just a second, because you know, you talked about equity, and I want to bring into the conversation someone with a different point of view on this. Joining us now from Fresh Meadows, New York, is David Weprin. He's a Democratic State Assemblyman who's represented New York's 24th District in Queens since 2010. He's a vocal opponent of the congestion pricing plan and voted against the budget that included the plan. Assemblyman Weprin, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So what's your objection here to this congestion pricing plan? How might it affect your constituents?
Well, you know, I live in what's often referred to as a transit desert in eastern Queens, where there is no subway station, and you often have to take two buses to get to the subway. So if you're trying to get into Midtown Manhattan from parts of eastern Queens, it can often take 2 hours. But if you drive to Manhattan, you can make it in an hour, even with traffic. So it's going to be a tremendous burden on those individuals who do drive into Manhattan for business, who feel they have to. And they're actually not the ones causing the congestion in Midtown Manhattan. They're basically just driving to their place of work, parking their car, and then going home at night. So, you know, this plan, which I've been fighting in different forms for over 10 years, going back to Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who I serve with in the New York City Council, I don't think addresses congestion at all. There are major problems with congestion in Manhattan, but this plan is just a tax revenue raiser for the MTA, along with, you know, other taxes.
Well, let me ask you, though. I mean, the New York City subway system is in dire need of help. I'm seeing, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm seeing like capital needs around $40 billion, right? And this congestion pricing plan is supposed to raise, I don't know, what, $15 billion? That's a significant amount for a system that serves even folks in Queens as well. So why wouldn't they benefit from a healthier subway system in New York?
Well, the term $15 billion is a little misleading. What they're hoping to raise is $1 billion in revenue, and they're hoping to bond it out and have $15 billion in bond issues over the next couple of years by securitizing that revenue stream of $1 billion. So it's really only $1 billion they're raising, and there are plenty of other ways to raise that revenue stream. But I think the first issue has to be trying to find savings within the MTA themselves. The governor's been talking about restructuring the MTA. I don't see that happening. People are skeptical about how the money is used. Over the years, we've passed a number of taxes specifically for the MTA, and a lot of people want to know what happened with that money. There's a payroll tax specifically dedicated to the MTA in the MTA region, often referred to as a mobility tax. That tax has been around for a number of years. There are so many other charges that actually do go to the MTA that drivers pay. So, you know, I think it's a little unfair that the bulk of the burden for the MTA raising money should fall on the part of drivers. And again, the congestion in Manhattan right now is really not due to individual passenger vehicles driving into work for work or for medical appointments. The bulk of it is the explosion of app-based car services that have exploded all over Midtown Manhattan. Uber, Lyft, Juno, many other black cars or individuals driving their own car under one of these affiliations. And if you're driving in Midtown Manhattan, almost every plate next to you and moving around is a TLC plate, Taxi and Limousine Commission plate, and they're not yellow cabs and they're not green cabs. They're cars that look like regular private cars,
right?
But they're really TLC affiliated with either Uber, Lyft,
Yeah.
Juno, so, one
of those
companies.
David Weprin, hang on here for just a second because I got to take a quick break, and David Meyer, stand by as well. We're talking about New York City becoming the first American city to launch a congestion pricing plan. The first in the United States. Again, we'll pick up on what's happened in other cities that have done this around the world. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the fact that New York City, in late 2020, will become the first American city to institute a congestion pricing plan. Now, the idea here is that in the most congested parts of New York City, some drivers will be charged an extra toll to bring their cars into that part of the city. And then that money that's getting raised will go to help the beleaguered subway system there and ideally reduce traffic and air pollution as well. This is the first city in America to do this. It's been done in London and Stockholm and Singapore. Globally, we'll talk about international results in a second. But here's how New York Mayor Bill de Blasio talked about it when he was on the station WQHT's morning show last week, and why he's in favor of congestion pricing.
We're discouraging people from bringing their cars into a place that's already ridiculously congested. But if you're going to do it, you're going to have to pay something extra. That money will go to the subways to fix the subways.
That's New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. And here are how some New York residents felt about the plan. They talked to CBS New York on Sunday.
I work in Manhattan a lot, and I don't mind paying for it to get in there. And if it helps congestion, even better.
Congestion pricing will be an added hardship for Charles Alvarez, who lives in the toll zone but needs to visit his mother in a Queens nursing home.
That's crazy. I can't imagine doing that. But I have to see my mother, and it's just something that would greatly impact me.
Well, we're joined today by David Meyer, senior reporter for the news advocacy organization Streets Blog NYC. We're also joined by David Weprin, Democratic State Assemblyman who's represented New York's 24th District in Queens since 2010. And Assemblyman Weprin, I know we've got to let you go here in just a minute, but I did want to ask you one final question kind of about the big picture here. Because I heard you say before the break that it's unfair to folks like your constituents to have to shoulder an extra burden in order to help pay for the New York City subway's dire needs. But, you know, on the other hand, historically in the United States, the government has largely subsidized or almost largely subsidized roads and bridges forever. We've all been paying for the infrastructure that drivers have used. So why not look for new funding models that would help mass transit even more?
Well, I have no problem with funding models. I just don't think this is the right model. One is I don't think it'll reduce congestion. I haven't seen it. And, I think people that feel they have to drive into Manhattan will still drive into Manhattan. And if everybody that does drive into Manhattan all of a sudden took a subway and bus, there's no way that they could accommodate that kind of, addition. Right now, people can barely get on subways, they often have to let 5, 6 or even more cars go by before they can actually get on the train because they're so crowded. There's a lot of, issues with that. There aren't enough, trains, and they don't come often enough. And that's why mm-hmm. a lot of people choose to drive, because, they feel that the subway is not, a working system for them and a reliable system. So, we'll see. Again, I wish this plan, really had a congestion element in it, with a real plan to reduce congestion, dealing with, these app-based cars all over Manhattan, the yeah. Uber and Lyfts, dealing with commercial vehicles. I've been advocating to eliminate a program that New York City instituted under Mayor Bloomberg called the Stipulated Fine Program, where commercial companies, like Federal Express and others that have many commercial vehicles making deliveries in the middle of the day, pay a reduced fine, and they pay only a reduced ticket, and they pay that amount on an annual basis mm-hmm. or a monthly basis, and they can basically double park freely for a long period right. of time during the day, and that's causing major congestion.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of construction-related congestion happening in Midtown, so the congestion problem is really not the passenger vehicles. It's really, other issues.
I see. Well, David Weprin, Democratic State Assemblyman who's represented New York's 24th District in Queens since 2010, joining us today from Fresh Meadows, New York. David Weprin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Magnum.
Okay. So, David Meyer, let me just turn back to you really quickly. Obviously, Assemblyman Weprin has a whole list of concerns about the congestion pricing plan. But let's just get your quick response to what he ended with there. That if you're really trying to reduce traffic problems in a place like New York right now, he says it's not the passenger vehicles that are the issue. So what's going on? What's causing all the traffic there?
So it's true that the number of for-hire vehicles, Uber, Lyfts, et cetera, has ballooned in the last 5 years and really negatively impacted congestion. To say that they are the only thing impacting congestion is flatly false. They're an easy scapegoat, but ultimately they are a small percentage of the vehicles on the road in Manhattan. They might be more concentrated in certain parts of Manhattan, but they are not the bulk of the congestion problem. The bulk of the congestion problem is now and has always been single occupancy vehicles.
David, I'm going to jump in on you. David, I'm going to jump in on you here because there's something, there's a ghost in the machine between us and your line there in New York. So we're going to see if we can fix that. Let's go to a call really quickly. Let's go to Jesse, who's calling from Old Lyme, Connecticut. Jesse, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. You know, being in the tri-state area, interacting with New York, obviously everything is done strategically, when you're going and how you're getting there, the whole nine. But a lot of people that like driving into the city, they choose very strategically where they're going to live. Let's say Long Island, there's three bridges getting on. And now we just seen what is the Verrazano Narrows, I think, is now the highest toll bridge in the country, I think. How are surrounding communities worried about movement as far as living situations? So let's say, okay, well, some people living in Long Island, oh, they might have to sacrifice driving their car because of this, so they might even choose to move. Are the local mayors, selectmen, councilmen, are they chiming in on this and how it's going to affect their community as far as commuters getting into the city and where they choose to live to do that more strategically and to save money?
Yeah. Well, Jesse, thank you so much for your call. You know, to me, what's the heart of this issue here is a chance to interrogate sort of historically how Americans, how we've all decided to pay for transportation and transportation infrastructure in this country, and why we haven't had congestion pricing until now, where, as in other cities around the world, it's been in place for several decades. So we've got a good point of comparison here, and I'd like to explore that for some time. So joining now from London is Nicole Badstuber. She's a researcher who studies urban systems and infrastructure at the University of Cambridge's Center for Smart Infrastructure and Construction. She recently wrote a piece headlined London Congestion Charge, What Worked, What Didn't, and What Next. The link to that is at onpointradio.org. Nicole Badstuber, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so, you know, we've been very deep in the weeds regarding the specifics around New York City. But I just want to underscore the fact that not until 2020 will we have a city that has any kind of congestion pricing in the United States, whereas London has had it since, what, 2002, roughly?
Yeah, 2003.
Okay, so what was the initial impetus to basically create this ring around the central part of London where drivers would have to pay more to enter it? Why did they want to do that?
Well, I mean, it was congestion. We had our first mayor who was elected, and he got a mandate. It was in his manifesto to introduce a congestion charge, and he did so. He ring-fenced all the money that was generated from this charge for public transport, and when it was introduced in 2003, it was introduced alongside 300 extra buses that were going into the central congestion charging zone.
So they increased mass transit at the same time that they put the congestion charge in. Interesting. Okay. So then looking back 15, 16 years, how successful has the plan been? Has traffic been reduced measurably in central London?
Yeah, so there were some studies done 10 years after the congestion charge was introduced. And still today, we see that traffic numbers are down 25%. Traffic numbers for private cars in particular are down 39%. So markedly down for people using single occupancy vehicles to enter central London.
Okay, but I'm reading, though, still that average sort of speeds in central London actually aren't that much better, though. I mean, that there's still very heavy traffic use there.
Yeah, so when you have a road, it usually fills up, but it's who's using that. So we've been able to reallocate some of the space to pedestrians and cycle infrastructure. So although congestion is sort of at equal levels as it was before the charge was introduced, now more space is dedicated to other road users.
Ah, okay. Interesting. And then what about the transit side of the equation? Was substantial revenue raised to support, I guess, the London Underground or mass transit in general in Greater London?
Yeah, so we have an integrated transport authority. It would be equivalent of the MTA and the Department for Transportation in one. They're in charge of all public transport and the main streets. So they generate about £250 million a year from the charge, which sounds maybe a lot, but is only about 2% of the budget. So it's an £11 billion annual budget that the Transport for London has. So it's It is, of course, it makes a difference, but it's a small amount of money in comparison to the large capital costs that the city has.
We're talking about a massive system there in London, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and what about the air quality issue, right? Because, congested areas go hand in hand with bad air. Has the air gotten better in central London?
We are about to introduce an ultra-low emission zone, which will cover the same area on Monday, which will charge vehicles which don't meet strict emission targets. So we are trying to actually take more steps to improve air quality because London is regularly exceeding the limits set by the European Union on what air quality should be in the city. But introducing the congestion charge did make a difference. The following year, emissions were down around 16%.
Okay. So I'm looking at the headline of your piece, congestion charge, what worked, what didn't, and what's next? So it sounds like quite a bit worked here. So what didn't work?
So what I think is important to remember is that this charge was conceived in the 1990s and the technology that was available was pretty low tech to what we're used to now. So it's a really basic charge. You pay a daily charge for entering the most central part of London, and that's only on weekdays. It's only between 7 and 6 p.m. And a lot of vehicles are exempt. So our equivalent of four hire vehicles are exempt because back in the 1990s, no one had conceived of Uber, and the way that they're registered means that they're exempt. Also, motorcycles are exempt. Residents get a 90% discount on the charge. And I think looking ahead, the area only covers about 1.5% of the city. So we need to think about how we can tackle congestion and more in a better way. Congestion isn't only a problem in this most central part of the city. And we're seeing a real slowdown of public transport based on the road, so essentially buses. Bus speeds are down, and as a result, bus passenger numbers are slowing down too, or even falling. So we need to look at how we can use our roads more effectively and with higher capacity modes.
Okay, so David Meyer in New York. Hopefully the line's a little better now because we couldn't hear you a couple of minutes ago.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, so we'll keep our fingers crossed that this holds up. In listening to Nicole Badstuber about lessons learned in London, what example do you think that's setting for New York City?
I think the most important thing is that we get our charges right and that we use the money and the space that we clear up by removing these cars to create more effective alternatives for folks. So that includes bus lanes and bike lanes. London congestion decreased by 44%. The number of cars, rather, decreased by 44%, and the number of people increased by 23%. So ideally, we're going to not only use this revenue to invest into our transit system, mm-hmm. but actually create a tolling system that reduces the number of cars going in and out of the Central Business District. And Assemblymember Weprin earlier is totally correct. The plan that the Assembly and Senate put forward doesn't actually say how it's going to reduce congestion. And in the next year and a half, that's going to be a big question weighing on us.
David and Nicole, and David, I'll start with you. I'm just wondering if this concept of congestion pricing is really something that can only work in cities like New York, like London, like Singapore, that have a hand-in-hand, very established mass transit systems. Because there are other major cities in the United States that have tons of traffic problems, but maybe not the mass transit infrastructure that they need to deal with what happens when you try to reduce the number of single occupancy vehicles that come into the city. You know, we at the very beginning of the show, we mentioned Atlanta and Houston, Los Angeles, for example. I mean, LA maybe is a bit of an outlier. What do you think? I mean, is this a model that has limited utility, David, in the United States?
I mean, it certainly helps us here in New York when we're making the case about congestion pricing to our neighbors and other New Yorkers to say, hey, we all take the subway, we all take the railroads, just hop on with the rest of us. And it's available for everybody. And to response from the to respond to the caller from earlier, who asked about whether there was any movement around housing, there isn't actually. The Long Island politicians are actually just want a piece of the pie because they actually want transit investments in their districts. But when we look to cities like Boston and Seattle, in particular, and San Francisco, which do have strong transportation infrastructure, transit infrastructure that should obviously be better and could be better, I think congestion pricing could be viable in cities like Boston, San Francisco, and Seattle. Los Angeles, Houston, and Atlanta, I'm not familiar with them enough to think it would be to say whether or not it would be viable, but it certainly seems like a stretch given how strong the argument that, hey, you can just take the subways in New York worked here.
Right. Well, Nicole Badstuber, what do you think about that? I mean, actually, let me ask you, when the congestion pricing was first launched in London, did it receive objection or significant pushback from drivers who commute in and out of central London?
Everyone was against it. The policy advisors of the mayor at the time, you know, were advising him up to the last minute to not do it. And then once it came in, everyone saw what the benefits were. And now I don't think anyone would be in favor of taking it away again. To your question about what can cities do who don't have a legacy railway infrastructure, I think what we can do is make better use of the road infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You know, you can paint bus lanes, you can buy buses, and you can use the roads that already exist to provide a high capacity road-based public transport system that can, transport many more people than we do in a single occupancy vehicle lane.
Right. Well, Nicole Badstuber and David Meyer, hang on here for a second because we do have to take a quick break. We're talking about the fact that in late 2020, after the 2020 elections, New York City will become the first American city to institute a congestion pricing plan, meaning that drivers who want to come into the most congested areas of New York will have to pay a new toll. And the idea is to reduce traffic, to reduce air pollution, and to increase funding for other forms of transportation. And really, is it time for America to think of new ways to pay for how we move around? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the fact that in late 2020, New York City is going to introduce congestion pricing to the city, meaning some drivers will have to pay a toll to enter the most traffic-heavy parts of New York City. It's the first time it will have been done in the United States. It's a plan that's been launched over the past several decades in other international cities to largely positive but some mixed results as well. Here's New York Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo announcing on Sunday his budget bill, which included this congestion pricing plan. He says it'll discourage car use and work to reform the subway system in New York.
Today, we've gotten it done. First state in the nation. And it's been done in some places around the world, Singapore, Stockholm, London. Nowhere in the United States. It forms a central business district, charges a higher rate for traveling within that central business district. It's designed to reduce congestion, raise revenue.
Seems simple, right? Reduce congestion, raise revenue. So that's Andrew Cuomo in 2019. Back in 2003, when London created a congestion pricing zone in central London, the Associated Press talked to a Londoner to see what he thinks, and also then-Mayor Ken Livingstone.
You can't get rid of congestion. People are going to try to get on tubes to get around it. The tubes can't handle it at the moment, so you're going to have chaos everywhere.
Every traffic engineer in the world is following this, every city administration. And clearly, in America, where I addressed the American Conference of Mayors on this, a lot of them said, well, if it works and you get re-elected, I'll do it. But they took those two stages as important.
That's former London Mayor Ken Livingstone and a regular Londoner you heard before that. Ken Livingstone there speaking in 2003. It's now 2019, and New York City will finally have congestion pricing in 2020. So let's go to Elizabeth, who's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Elizabeth, you're on the air. What do you think of this idea of finding new ways to pay for how we move around?
Hi, I think it's a great idea. I live in Lexington, Kentucky now, but I used to live in Singapore. I travel back fairly regularly, and it's one of those things where it does take a little bit of a mindset shift if you're used to getting in a car and getting somewhere. But I will say, having traveled on the subway system in New York, which is maybe less than an ideal trip, and having traveled on the subway system in Singapore, there, it's not very crowded very regularly. There's always enough trains. You know, it's a pretty pleasant experience of how to get around. My parents, who commuted when we lived in Singapore to their jobs, you know, they used to say, if we lived in Manhattan or if we lived in a city in the United States, we would probably drive because it's just easier. It's faster. But in Singapore, where they do have congestion pricing, unless we were trying to get somewhere lickety-split, mm-hmm. it really just made more sense to get on the subway or on the other like mass transit system, like the bus.
Right.
They were just a pleasant experience. And so even going back this summer with my husband for the first time, who had never been, he was like, we're going to take the subway everywhere? And I was like, yes, just trust me. Yeah. We got to the subway station. He was like, oh, okay, I don't want to get in the cab. Cabs cost more money. You know, you have to pay for that congestion pricing, and it just wasn't worth it
right.
half the time. It made so much more sense to get on the subway. So I think if New York executes as well, it would be a great thing to implement. Maybe not in every city in the United States, but definitely in some, like New York.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for your call. David Meyer, let me turn back to you there, because I take Elizabeth's point about it's maybe right now it's somewhat of a chicken and an egg problem, because for as long as a lot of people don't see the subway or mass transit as an effective alternative that's just not as convenient for them as driving, you know, how much behavior change, how much mindset shift are we going to see as she said is required?
Well, the equation in New York is such now that upwards of 70% of people take transit or walk or bike to work. So the amount of people who are actually weighing, am I going to take a car or take the subway? I think it's a very small percentage of people. The one thing that we need to recognize now is that right now it is faster to walk or bike in the central business district than it is to take a cab or drive. So ultimately, the point that the caller just made is exactly right. If we charge people to drive in the central business district, then speeds in the central business district will increase. And the incentive to drive in the central business district in some ways, you know, you'll be able to decide if you need to get somewhere lickety-split, you can get somewhere lickety-split. If you want to take your time, you can take the subways. But there's the attrition from the transit system so far has really been to Ubers and Lyfts
yes.
in recent years. And the population of the city has gone up. Subway and bus ridership is actually cratering, but subway ridership is pretty much stagnant. Meanwhile, you know, if you're trying to get home at 11 p.m. at night, for-hire vehicle only costs, you know, $8, $9, $10 to get home, and it comes right away, whereas the bus only comes every 15, 20 minutes, sometimes only every hour.
David, can I just have jump in here for a second?
Twice as long.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I really want to know, because maybe it wasn't clear earlier at the beginning of the show. Would Ubers and Lyfts be exempted from this new congestion pricing toll?
So that is to be determined by this panel. However, last year, the State Assembly and State Senate passed a $2.75 fee enacted on all taxi trips. So by taxis, I mean Ubers, Lyft, yellow cabs that travel within the central business district. So that's already been in effect and already impacting the bottom line of those drivers and whether people are taking those trips. The question is whether they'll be charged the additional congestion fee come 2020 or not.
Well, why wouldn't
the
taxi
they? Driver
I can't.
Don't want that.
Well, the taxi driver union, but regarding these, the transportation network companies or the Ubers and Lyfts of the world that, as you just said, are a major source of the increased congestion in a lot of cities, what's the argument to not charge them the congestion pricing fee?
Well, the argument is very simply that they're already being charged a congestion fee.
$2.75, but then individual drivers would have to pay $10 or more? It doesn't make sense.
You'll get no argument from me on that end. But the politics of it are very, very complicated. And ultimately, whether the TNCs and taxis are included, transportation network companies and taxis are included in this bridge toll or cordon below 60th Street plan is to be determined and going to be a big political fight.
So, Nicole Badstuber, Uber and Lyft and these new ways of moving people around are sort of they're the front edge of a transportation revolution. Has this become an issue in London as well? Or are they just automatically charged the fee?
No, they're actually exempt. And we've seen for hire vehicle registrations go up 75% in the last few years. They're definitely contributing hugely to the congestion problem, especially on Friday and Saturday nights where
they're exempt?
18,000 enter the charging zone. Yeah, they were currently exempt. So the mayor has suggested that he is looking at charging them, but currently they do not pay a fee at all.
Other than the companies themselves, who is pushing back against the idea of charging what's effectively a form of a taxi service the fee? This is something I'm having a difficulty wrapping my mind around.
I don't know how to give you a good argument for not charging them. But I guess the for hire vehicles will argue that the black cabs, so our equivalent of the yellow cabs, are also exempt. There were no proposals so far to charge taxis. If we want to look at charging or pricing our roads more fairly, and people are paying £1.50 for a bus ride and they're fitting into the space of about two cars, then we should be paying for the luxury of having either hailing a for hire vehicle or a cab and the amount of space you're using up for that. So currently, as I said, it's a very basic system and they are not paying.
Okay. Well, let's go back.
Here in New York,
Here
in New York, it's all caught up in the politics of the taxi industry more generally. You know, five years ago or more, driving a black car or a taxi was not just livable, but perhaps even an upper middle class life. And with the influx of, we've had the same thing in New York as they've had in London, you know, tens of thousands of new vehicles on the road collecting passengers, the amount of money that the drivers are making has gone down. And that is happening at the same time as these congestion fees are being enacted, which has made the politics of actually how those are imposed on the for-hire vehicles much more complicated, because there is this wage and workers' rights issue accompanying it at the same time. And actually, in last year, the New York City Council capped the number of Ubers and Lyfts and transportation network company vehicles in the city. It's a one-year cap, and after that, they're supposed to come up with a report for a plan to limit their growth in the future. The idea is that the two things can, if they're not tackled together, they can be tackled separately, certainly.
Okay, well, let's go back to our callers. Mike is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Mike, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, to your listeners. I think it's a bad idea. I would turn things around from the way you said it, and instead of thinking of new ways to pay for highway and bridge construction expansion, turn around and pay those people and this could be implemented nationwide, pay those people who don't put so many miles on the odometers of the vehicles they are registered in the country. And that way you don't have all this highway construction, and it also reduces the congestion and air pollution and global warming, et cetera.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Margo, who's calling from Danbury, Connecticut. Margo, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had two questions. One is, it seems theoretically like a good idea, but I'm wondering if your guest could comment on the idea that it seems like upper middle class or wealthy people won't really be impacted, but it could have a really significant impact on people, you know, who are sort of already struggling financially, and small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And then my second question is, people who live in the zone, will they be exempt, like sort of grandfathered into having no, you know, to be able to kind of come and go if they're already driving cars in and out of their home?
Well, Margo, thank you so much for your call. And I'm actually going to start with Nicole Badstuber about this because London's got more than 15 years of experience under its belt now. So first of all, Margo, was there an impact on lower income Londoners or a disproportionate impact on them when the congestion pricing zone was created?
I think it's important to remember that people in the lower income bands are actually using public transport much more to get around. Buses in particular, which are about 75% of motorised travel that people in the lowest income band make. So actually introducing a congestion charge and reducing the number of traffic on the road speeds up buses and actually gives those people a better travel experience and better access to jobs and opportunities. So yeah, that would be my sort of argument.
Okay, and then the second part of Margot's question about whether or not people living in the zone could be grandfathered in or perhaps exempt, I guess. Is that what happened in London?
Yes. So currently residents in or just adjacent to the congestion charging area get a 90% reduction or 90% discount on the annual charge that they would have to pay. I would actually argue against that because especially in the areas that New York is considering or that we have here in London, those are very areas that are very accessible from a public transport public transport point of view. And often those people who are residents are then just using up public space, the roads, to park their private vehicle. And they have options. They don't need to drive into the area.
David Meyer, there's kind of a big picture question in the last couple of minutes here that I want to discuss with both you and Nicole. Because Nicole mentioned a couple of minutes ago about if we're really talking about pricing roads more fairly, you know, how do we do that? And it seems to me that in the United States, I mean, after the 1950s, our entire culture was built around the automobile. That it's fair to say that people look at their access to roads as a right rather than something that they need to pay the true cost for. So, I mean, how do we need to shift that fundamental mindset in order to come up with any new ways to really adequately fund transportation, both roadways and railways?
Yeah, I mean, car ownership is prohibitively expensive. It costs a lot to pay for insurance. It costs a lot to pay for the car. It costs a lot of time and money to get the car repaired and to get parts replaced, et cetera, et cetera. I understand, and I mean, I'm an American, I understand that we think of our access to the road as this free, unfettered thing, but it's not. It actually weighs us down financially and emotionally and in other ways. So in terms of actually funding transit as opposed to transportation, ultimately, there needs to be just a complete and total shift in priorities that needs to honestly start at the federal level. It's great that New York, because it has this amazing transportation ecosystem that's been around for 100 plus years, can sort of just flip the coin and say, actually, we're going to charge drivers to enter. We'll raise more money for the transit system that needs it. Nationally, without investment in public transit, without investment in buses, without investment in more trains, it's going to be hard to make that argument to people. You know, the carrot has to come alongside the stick. And that was a big part of getting congestion pricing over the line here in New York, was convincing legislators that the money was going to be well spent, and it was going to be well spent on projects affecting their constituents in their districts.
Right. I mean, it seems like historically the true cost of driving on America's roads has always been somewhat hidden from most drivers, and that we're looking for ways to make it less hidden. And that's where we get the pushback.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's hard. A lot of my time I spend covering bike lane projects, which remove parking spots. It's the same thing. It's hard to take something away from people. It's hard to add a new fee. It doesn't make doing that
the wrong thing to do. And moving through all those politics, I mean, in New York, it took 14 years to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And New York is the most transit-rich city in America and one of the most transit-rich cities in the world.
Right. So. Well, and it is continuously incumbent on lawmakers to find fair ways of doing this. So, Nicole Badstuber, we've got about 30 seconds left to go. What would be your advice to New York lawmakers as they look ahead to try to figure out exactly how to set their price and who to exempt? What's your best piece of advice for them?
So I would advise that rather than seeing it as a revenue generator, that's seeing the revenue generated as a side benefit, the main objective should be to reduce traffic. And to do that, we also need to give people an option, which is a good public transport system alongside charging for road access.
Well, Nicole Badstuber is a researcher who studies urban systems and infrastructure at the University of Cambridge's Center for Smart Infrastructure and Construction, speaking to us today from London. Nicole, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And David Meyer, senior reporter for the news advocacy organization Streets Blog NYC, speaking to us from New York City. David Meyer, it was great to have you. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.